The Mysterious Old Radio Listening Society Podcast.
Welcome to the Mysterious Old Radio Listening Society, a podcast dedicated to suspense, crime, and horror stories from the golden age of radio. I'm Eric.
I'm Tim.
And I'm Joshua.
We love mysterious old-time radio stories, but do they stand the test of time? That's what we're here to find out.
Today, we present an episode of my choosing, August Heat from Suspense.
Radio's outstanding theater of thrills debuted on CBS in 1942 and ran for an astounding 20 years. During that time, Suspense featured a cavalcade of stars, including today's leading man, Ronald Colman.
Colman, known for his suave demeanor and resonant voice, achieved fame in the 1930s as the star of such celebrated films as Lost Horizon and A Tale of Two Cities. His portrayal of Anthony Tony John in A Double Life earned him an Academy Award in 1947. During the war, Colman transitioned to radio, where he became a familiar voice in programs like The Halls of Ivy, The Jack Benny Program, and Favorite Story.
August Heat is based on a 1910 short story by W.F. Harvey, an English writer known for his supernatural fiction. Today, Harvey is primarily remembered for his 1919 story, The Beast with Five Fingers. Widely regarded as the prototypical disembodied hand story, The Beast with Five Fingers gained notoriety in 1946 as the basis of the Robert Florey film starring Peter Lorre.
The Suspense adaptation of August Heat directly quotes The Prophet by Lebanese-American writer Khalil Gibran. The book consists of 26 philosophical fables delivered by the titular prophet who shares his wisdom on various aspects of life, including love, marriage, freedom, and death. Since its publication in 1923, The Prophet has sold millions of copies worldwide.
In 1948, CBS extended the runtime of Suspense from 30 minutes to an hour. As part of this experiment, Suspense presented a second production of August Heat, paired with an adaptation of John Collier's darkly comic Wet Saturday. Barry Kroger stepped in for Ronald Colman, along with Dennis Hoey, who returned to reprise the role of Charles Atkinson.
Today we will listen to the original production starring Ronald Colman, first broadcast May 31st, 1945.
It's late at night, and a chill has set in. You're alone, and the only light you see is coming from an antique radio. Listen to the sounds coming from the speaker. Listen to the music, and listen to the voices.
Now, the Roma Wine Company of Fresno, California presents
Suspense. Tonight, Roma Wines bring you the distinguished actor, Mr. Ronald Colman, in one of the great suspense stories of our time, August Heat.
Suspense is presented for your enjoyment by Roma Wines. That's R-O-M-A, Roma Wines. Those excellent California wines that can add so much pleasantness to the way you live, to your happiness in entertaining guests, to your enjoyment of everyday meals. Before we bring you Ronald Colman and our suspense play, here's a brief message from Elsa Maxwell, famed for her great charm as a hostess.
When food looks appetizing, it almost always lives up to expectations. When even so simple a main dish as a steaming, fragrant bowl of spaghetti or beans is surrounded by bright green salads, golden rolls or muffins, and brilliant Roma California burgundy, the food is more enjoyable, more delightful.
And for a summery touch of the outdoors, a vase of flowers, perfect color complement to the deep, rich beauty of Roma burgundy. You'll enjoy the fruity, robust taste, the tart piquancy of distinguished Roma Burgundy served cool. Truly a masterpiece of fine winemaking. Like all Roma wines, Roma Burgundy is unvaryingly good, always high in quality of bouquet, color, and taste. The happy reward of selected grapes, brought slowly to perfection, gently pressed, then carefully guided to flavor fullness by the ancient skill of Roma's noted wineries in California's choicest vineyards. Yet all this goodness is yours for only pennies a glass. Remember, more Americans enjoy Roma than any other wine. R-O-M-A, Roma wines. Yes, right now a glass full would be very pleasant, as Roma wines bring you a remarkable tale of suspense.
And with August Heat, W.F. Harvey's matchless narrative of premonition and the brooding terror of twilight and the unseen, and with the performance of Ronald Coleman, Roma wines hope indeed to keep you in suspense.
Peniston Road, Clapham, August the 20th, 1945. I have had what I believe to be the most remarkable day in my life. And while the events are still fresh in my mind, I wish to put them down on paper as clearly as possible. Let me say at the outset that my name is James Clarence Withencroft. You must remember that in order to have the full implication of my story. James Clarence Withencroft. I'm 40 years old, in perfect health, never having known a day's illness. By profession, I am an artist. Not a very successful one, but I earn enough money by my black and white work to satisfy my necessary wants. My only near relative, a sister, died 5 years ago, so that there is no one in particular to whom I address this manuscript. Only you, who might by chance read it someday. For, because of the peculiar circumstance about which you will soon hear, I have the strong premonition that I shall never live to tell anyone about it. I breakfasted this morning at 9 at the usual time. It was no different from any other morning. And after glancing through the morning paper, I lighted my pipe. And I proceeded to let my mind wander in the hope that I might chance upon some subject for my pencil. The room, though door and window were open, was oppressively hot. And I had just made up my mind that the coolest and most comfortable place in the neighborhood would be the deep end of the public swimming bath, when I was suddenly shaken. A feeling swept over me such as I'd never experienced before. I attempted to rise to my feet, but somehow it seemed as though I had suddenly been fastened to my chair. My hand went out in an effort to brace myself. And then, before I knew what I was doing, my pencil was in my hand, and I began to draw. It was as though someone had taken my hand and was moving it across the paper, swiftly, in bold strokes. And then I seemed to take over. My hand, under its own power, began to draw. I soon forgot the oppressive heat. Everything was forgotten in this frantic feeling that the sketch must be finished as soon as possible. I had no idea how long I worked until I heard the clock of St. Jude's in the distance. It was 4 o'clock, and I had started just after breakfast. Now, for the first time since I'd begun, I actually seemed to see what I had been sketching. I was surprised. The final result was, I felt sure, the best thing I'd ever done. It showed a criminal in the dock immediately after the judge had pronounced sentence. The man was fat, enormously fat. The flesh hung in rolls about his chin. It creased his huge, stumpy neck. He was clean-shaven, or perhaps I should say a few days before he must have been clean-shaven. And he was almost bald. He stood there before the judge, his short, clumsy fingers clasping the rail, looking straight in front of him. The feeling that his expression conveyed was not so much one of horror as of utter, absolute collapse. There seemed nothing in the man strong enough to sustain that mountain of flesh. And then I saw that the sketch wasn't complete, for the man's other hand seemed to be clutching an instrument of some kind, a weapon, but it hadn't been completed. I had made this sketch, and yet I had no recollection of what I'd intended the man to carry in his other hand. I took up my pencil again, and I attempted to fill in the fuzzy outline, but it was useless. It was as though my fingers had suddenly turned to lead. I sat down, and I felt the moisture slowly forming on my forehead. And once again, I was conscious of the oppressive heat. Then I knew that there would be no finishing of the sketch, at any rate not for the moment. So I rolled it up, and without quite knowing why, I put it in my pocket. In spite of my peculiar inspiration, I was filled with a rare sense of happiness which the knowledge of a good thing well done gives. I believe that I set out with the idea of calling upon Trenton, for I remember walking along Lytton Street and turning to the right along Gilchrist Road, at the bottom of the hill where the men are at work on the new tram line. From there onwards, I have only the vaguest recollection of where I went. Through parks, along crowded streets, always conscious of the awful heat that came up from the dusty asphalt pavement in a suffocating wave. I remember, too, the hollow sound of my footsteps as I moved along. Although walking aimlessly, I somehow knew that there was a goal, a something to which I was drawn. I longed for the thunder promised by the great banks of copper-colored clouds that hung low over the western sky. I've really no idea how far I walked when a small boy roused me from my abstraction.
Have you got the time, mister?
7:20.
Thanks. Hot enough for you, sir?
Yes. When he left me, I began to take stock of my bearings. I found myself standing before a gate that led into a yard bordered by a strip of thirsty earth. There were flowers, purple stock and scarlet geranium, and great numbers of bees droned over them. I stood looking down at them for a moment, and then, for some reason, I looked up. Over the entrance to the place, there was a board with the inscription, Charles Atkinson, Monumental Mason, Worker in English and Italian Marbles. From the yard itself came a cheery whistle, a noise of hammer blows, and the cold sound of steel meeting stone. A sudden impulse made me enter, and I went in the direction of the noise. There was a man, sitting with his back towards me. He was busy at work on a slab of curiously painted marble. Then, without turning, his hammer stopped in midair as he was about to bring it down on his chisel. He held his position a moment before turning, but I knew that he was aware of my presence, and when he turned, I saw his face. It was, although I'd never seen him before, it was the face of the man I had been drawing. Yes, it was the face of the man whose sketch was in my pocket. He sat there on his low stool, huge and elephantine, the sweat pouring from his scalp, not speaking. Then he took a red silk handkerchief and he mopped his brow. Although this face that looked up at me was the same as my sketch, the expression was absolutely different. Suddenly the puzzled expression left his face, and he smiled, as if we were old friends. And he walked over and he took my hand.
Good day, sir.
Good day. I'm sorry to intrude.
Not at all.
Everything is so hot and glary outside. This is like an oasis in the wilderness.
I don't know about an oasis, but it certainly is hot. Whew. Take a seat, sir.
He pointed to the end of the gravestone on which he was at work, and I sat down.
Whew. Very hot.
That's a beautiful piece of stone you've got hold of.
In a way it is. The surface here is as fine as anything you could wish. But there's a big flaw at the back. Oh, I don't expect you'd notice it.
Oh, I shouldn't think so.
I could never really do a good job at a bit of marble like that. It would be all right in the summer like this. Wouldn't mind the blasted heat. But wait until the winter comes.
Winter?
There's nothing quite like frost to find out the weak points in stone.
Oh.
A gravestone, you see.
Oh, I see. Mm. Then what's this one for?
You'd hardly believe if I was to tell you, but it's for exhibition. It's the truth. Artists have exhibitions, so do grocers and butchers. Oh, we have them too. All the latest little things in headstones, you know.
He went on to talk of marbles, which sort of marble best withstood wind and rain, and which were easiest to work. Then of his garden and some new sort of carnation he had bought. At the end of every other minute, he would drop his tools, wipe his shining head.
This heat. This heat's bad. A man's not responsible for what he does in this heat.
I said little, for I felt uneasy. There was something unnatural, uncanny in all of this. The feeling that I'd experienced it all before. The oppressive heat, the fragrance of the stucks in the air, the conversation about the marble, the flowers, everything as though I had experienced it before. And yet I knew that I'd never ever been in this section of town before. I tried to persuade myself that at least I'd seen him before, that his face, unknown to me, had found a place in some out-of-the-way corner of my memory. But I knew that I was practicing little more than a plausible piece of self-deception. As I sat there quietly, watching him, he looked up at me and he said...
There. What do you think of that?
He said it with an air of evident pride, of a job well done. I could sense that he was experiencing the same feeling I had experienced when I'd finished my sketch. Then he got up with a sigh of relief.
Hot. Hot, ain't it?
I was seated in such a position that I was unable to see his work. And for some reason, I didn't move. Suddenly, he began to read what he'd carved on the tombstone. He spoke deliberately and with a flat voice.
In the midst of life, we are in death. Born January 18, 1905.
I looked up at the start. This man had read my exact birthday.
He passed away very suddenly on August 20th, 1945.
That's today.
We usually use the present date on these exhibition stones.
Do you usually put a name on them, too?
Yes. Sacred to the memory of James Clarence Withencroft.
Cold shudder swept over me. And I sat there in silence. The sound of birds and crickets seemed loud in my ears as we stood there, looking at each other, saying nothing. And then he mopped his brow again.
Hot. Hot.
I was finally able to speak. Where did you see that name?
I didn't see it anywhere. I wanted some name and... I put down the first that came into my head.
It's a strange coincidence, but It happens to be mine.
Huh? That's your name? You're James Clarence...
Withencroft. Yes.
Well. And the dates?
I can only answer for the birth date. It's correct.
Oh. That's a rum go.
I made a sketch this morning of you.
Of me? But you've never seen me before.
No.
Oh. Oh.
I took my sketch from my pocket and I showed it to him. As he looked, the expression on his face altered until it became more and more like that of the man I had drawn.
And it was only the other day before that I told Mariah there were no such things as ghosts.
Neither of us had seen a ghost, but I knew what he meant. Then I spoke to him. You probably heard my name someplace.
Yes. You must have seen me somewhere and forgotten it.
Yes, yes.
Were you at Clacton-on-Sea last July?
No. No, I've never been to Clacton in my life.
Oh.
And we were silent for some time again. And we stood there looking at one another and at the two dates on the gravestone. And the birth one was right. And the other was today.
Well, come inside and have some supper.
His wife was a strange little woman, who was pallid with the look of those who live their lives indoors. Her husband introduced me as a friend of his who was an artist, and he informed her that I was staying to supper. I spoke, making some comment that I hoped I wouldn't be an intrusion, and she looked up at me and she said,
"You have a pleasing voice, Mr. Withencroft, and you're welcome in my home. I'm sorry Charles has not brought you here before."
Very little was said during the meal, and after the sardines and watercress had been removed, she walked over to a cupboard, and she took down a thin black book, and as she handed it to me, she spoke.
"Would you read aloud, Mr. Withencroft?"
Puzzled, I looked down at the book which she'd opened and placed before me. It was a very tiny book, The Prophet, it was called, by an author unknown to me with a strange Eastern name, Khalil Gibran. And my eyes fell across the page, and suddenly I was reading aloud, as she'd asked me to. Then Almitra spoke, saying, "We would ask now of death." And he said, "You would know the secret of death. But how shall you find it unless you seek it in the heart of life? The owl, whose night-bound eyes are blind unto the day, cannot unveil the mystery of light. If you would indeed behold the spirit of death, open your heart wide unto the body of life. For life and death are one, even as the river and the sea are one. In the depth of your hopes and desires lies your silent knowledge of the beyond. And like seeds dreaming beneath the snow, your heart dreams of spring. Trust the dreams, for in them is hidden the gate to eternity. Your fear of death is but the trembling of the shepherd when he stands before the king whose hand is to be laid upon him in honor. Is the shepherd not joyful beneath his trembling that he shall wear the mark of the king? Yet is he not more mindful of his trembling? For what is it to die but to stand naked in the wind and to melt into the sun? And what is it to cease breathing but to free the breath from its restless tides, that it may rise and expand and seek God unencumbered. Only when you drink from the river of silence shall you indeed sing. And when you have reached the mountaintop, then you shall begin to climb. And when the earth shall claim your limbs, then shall you truly dance. When I looked up, Mr. Atkinson had gone. But his wife stood before me, and as she took the book, she spoke.
Thank you.
Then I went outside. And I found Atkinson sitting on the gravestone and smoking. He looked up at me.
Hot. Hot. Man's not responsible for what he might do in this heat. She never asked anyone to read aloud before.
And then we talked about the sketch again. He looked at it.
Likeness is me, all right. On trial.
You must excuse my asking, but... do you know of anything you've done for which you could be put on trial?
No, I've done nothing. Not yet.
He got up, fetched a can from the porch, and he began to water the flowers.
Twice a day regular in the hot weather. And then the heat sometimes gets the better of the delicate ones. And ferns. Good Lord, they could never stand it. Where do you live?
I told him my address. It would take an hour's quick walk to get back home. And he stopped watering, and he faced me squarely.
It's like this. We'll look at the matter straight. If you both go back home tonight, you'd take your chance of accidents. A cart may run over you. There's always banana skins and orange peels, to say nothing of falling ladders.
He spoke of the improbable with an intense seriousness that would have been laughable 6 hours before. But I did not laugh.
The best thing we can do is for you to stay here till 12 o'clock.
Then it'll be tomorrow, do you see?
Yes.
We'll go upstairs and smoke. Maybe cooler inside.
And to my surprise, I agreed. We are sitting in a long, low room beneath the eaves. Atkinson has sent his wife to bed. He himself is busy sharpening some tools at a little oil stone, smoking one of my cigars the while. And as I look at my sketch before me, I suddenly see the fuzzy outline of what the man in the picture holds in his hands. But while I had not been able to sketch it before, I am able to do so now. It is a chisel, and it is stained with dark liquid. The sketch is completed now. The air seems charged with thunder, and I hear it in the distance. It is ominous, but it carries the hope of rain. Perhaps this damnable heat will be broken soon, and the day will soon be over. It is close to 12. I am writing this at a shaky table before the open window. The leg is cracked, and Atkinson, who seems a handy man with his tools, is going to mend it as soon as he has finished putting an edge on his chisel. There. It is 12. The day is over. And I shall be going home. But the heat is stifling. This heat is enough to send a man mad.
And so closes August Heat, in which Roma Wines have brought you Ronald Coleman as star of tonight's study in Suspense. Suspense is produced, edited, and directed by William Spear. Music for August Heat was composed by Lucian Morowick and conducted by Lud Gluskin. Dennis Hoy appeared as Atkinson.
This is Truman Bradley with a word for Roma Wines, the sponsor of Suspense. America's famed authority on hospitality, Elsa Maxwell, recently made this suggestion for gracious entertainment.
Your friends will respect your good taste when you serve delightful Roma California Toque, enjoyable at any time, with coffee or dessert, with nuts and fruit. I suggest serving Roma Toque cool.
A most timely suggestion from Miss Maxwell. You'll find flame-bright Roma Toque velvety smooth, moderately sweet, light, yet delightfully rich in color. And you'll find Roma wines always delicious, of unvarying fine quality and goodness. June is the month of weddings, and the most distinguished way to fate the June bride is by serving Roma California Champagne. Its golden sparkle and delicious, delightful dryness tell you that here is a truly fine champagne, Roma Champagne. Next time you plan for a special occasion, add this sparkling touch of perfection, good Roma Champagne.
Next Thursday, you will hear John Payne and Frank McHugh as stars of Suspense.
Presented by Roma Wines, R-O-M-A, made in California for enjoyment throughout the world. This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.
That was August Heat from Suspense. Here on the Mysterious Old Radio Listening Society podcast. Once again, I'm Eric.
I'm Tim.
And I'm Joshua.
Hoey. So, is that his name?
Sure. We were debating how to pronounce Dennis Hoey's name, even though it's in the recording. We didn't bother to pay any attention to it.
I'm sure it's a Dennis Hoey.
So we kept it out of the intro, and now I just brought it out.
That's all we're talking about.
Yeah. Hoey. So Joshua, you brought this, right?
Yes.
And, why did you bring this to the podcast?
Well, a month or so ago, as you gentlemen may or may not recall, depending on your age, we listened to the old nurse's tale from the Weird Circle, and we firmly established that Eric does not like Victorian ghost stories.
Right.
And so I set about looking for a Victorian ghost story that I thought Eric would like. And I failed.
Why do you think you failed?
No, because this is not a Victorian ghost story.
Oh.
But it has many things in common, I think, with Victorian ghost stories, but I think also has things that in it that Eric may admire.
Hmm.
It has a little more suspense, perhaps, than a traditional Victorian ghost story, particularly in the first half. But once it crosses that halfway mark, we get into a story that runs on the dread of inevitability,
mm-hmm.
which is something that a lot of Victorian ghost stories rely on. And there are no ghosts, but even inside the narrative, Mr. Atkinson at one point says, "Oh, I thought I didn't believe in ghosts."
Mm-hmm.
And they both acknowledge, well, this
This has
nothing to do with the ghost story, but it has that feel.
Right.
So that's why I brought it as this last ditch attempt to try to see if Eric can find some appreciation for that quality in a story, that slower pace, that sense of building dread.
Like you've just established right now.
Yes. Will Eric or won't he like it? But that's suspense. You're saying it's dread because you know he didn't like it. That's the inevitable conclusion.
Do you think I liked it or not?
I just thought it was funny to say.
Okay. Because I was like, get out of my head if you know. Because I've been over here with a straight face, trying to not give any details. I really disliked it. I'm so sorry. It was slow and waiting for the guy to die. But you said some things just now that made me go, oh, yeah, yeah. That's true. We're waiting for the inevitable. Did have that. The lack of reaction, the lack of humanity in the, not only the script, but in the actor's choices and the performance of it. It's so very stoic.
It's very British.
Yeah.
I will address that. This is slightly different than me giving my opinion, but, and it's not to argue with you, but I right. think part of that is the point of these are people who are in a situation that is so alien and weird, mm-hmm. there is no right way to react for them.
Yeah. I just want, you know, are you effing kidding me? like some kind of human to show up and react. Huh. Well, let's go inside and have dinner. Then we're going to smoke for a while, and then you're going to finish your drawing, and I'm going to sharpen my chisel in front of you. And
Look, or I could shoot that guy, and I'd be fine.
Or go as far away from that man as possible.
You think in the real world, mm-hmm. if you happened to cross this really strange coincidence,
mm-hmm. okay.
you would just freak out and run.
Yeah. I know me very well. I know me really well. I would say, well, look, dude, that's really weird. First of all, I wouldn't believe him that he...
elaborate prank that he got together with your wife and like, this is going to be hilarious.
Or an elaborate way to kill me and he does know me. Or either way, I'm getting out of there because if it's an elaborate prank, I'm mad because I hate pranks. That's mean. Pranks are mean. You know what the worst one is? That one where they scratch off the lottery ticket and for 10 minutes they think they won the lottery and it's a fake lottery ticket. You people should all be damned to hell for that prank. I hate that prank. You don't know what I'm talking about?
No.
Fake lottery tickets. You can buy them and then you watch friends scratch them off and it says you won all the money and then they film it and they put it on YouTube and people think it's hilarious. Anyway, makes me really mad.
Yeah, there's a special place in hell.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for agreeing with the look on your two faces. That actually happens.
Human beings do.
Oh, it happens. It's a thing. People do, and they think it's hilarious. Anyway, point being is that
I usually just punch my friend in the balls on their birthday and film it. It's a lot easier. I don't have to buy a fake card.
Listen, I have this idea for a TikTok thing about us punching each other in the balls that I think is going to go well. But any way I look at that scenario, staying there doesn't make any sense. But back to the actual production itself, this story that we just listened to, other than plot holes and human reaction, I guess.
Most people do not react like you react.
They situation. Would just sit there and go, hmm,
like you play you dead when name. Someone you don't know walks into the room. Like you're like high on that scale of like, this is weird.
If a guy walked in this room with my tombstone,
put that back. I'm going to need that.
I think that also it was just very slow, and it was suspense. So what am I waiting for? The twist. And there is no twist to this. We know that he's going to eventually draw the chisel in his hand. We know that he's going to kill him with the chisel. He tells us people do crazy things when it's hot. Well, you're going to do a crazy thing and kill him. Mm-hmm. We're just waiting for it to happen. I prayed up until the end that suspense was going to save this for me, and then it didn't. That's what happened. And then I went...
Well, I mean, the twist that they don't actually give you is that midnight strikes, and it's like, wow, that was weird. Well, it was nice to meet you. Bye.
I think that's a legitimate interpretation of this. Or the other question I think is interesting about this story is, was this all a coincidence that's still going to result in Atkinson murdering this guy because it's the actual coincidence?
Oh, that convinced him, like, I guess I got to kill him.
Yeah, because the heat was getting to this guy Atkinson, and it's sort of a self-fulfilling coincidence. Which comes first?
Right.
The chicken or the egg?
This Chegg.
That's a good name for a dog. Chegg.
He does kill him at the end of this.
No, it cuts away.
It strongly implies it's going to happen, but you don't.
The way you guys were just talking made me have that moment of, oh, crap, did I mislisten to this? But no, I just assumed he kills him.
No, because he's strongly implied. He's still narrating. So he's never cut off. He's writing that letter, and his letter ends.
When is he writing all this, by the way?
That's writing it in this guy's house.
While he's upstairs smoking at the end.
Like, why the guy's next to him or wherever, sharpening his
chisel. So the whole story is written in that moment.
That moment, yeah.
Okay, thank you. That actually helps me.
Which is not a great time to write something down normally. But
then he also finishes the drawing during that time as well.
So
it's very focused.
I'm gonna share a little about the original short story.
Yeah.
This is very, very, very true to the short story, but the short story is more ambiguous. Suspense clearly wanted to lead us down the path of supernatural premonition that ends for sure in murder. Suspense adds things like describing Wittencroft drawing almost as if he is possessed, like it's
right.
Automatic writing almost, the way it's described. And in the story, he's just like, and I sat down by the pool and drew a picture.
Right.
And I really liked it. And he also does not fill in a missing bloody chisel at the end of the story. It's eerie, and the coincidence is creepy, and it's definitely ominous, and there's a sense of inevitability. But I think there's more room in the story to go, maybe nothing happens.
Right. That's this older age of stories where the idea of the horror is the ambiguity and unknowableness of what this means, more so than, and I'm going to die.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And that's what I took away from this suspense version, is that the ambiguity they wanted to insert was, why does Atkinson kill Wittencroft? Is it because he was predestined to? Is it because this coincidence gave him this opportunity in the heat and he was already going a little crazy? The ambiguity of the original story is, does anything happen at all?
Let me tell you what my listening experience was. So I started listening, and like, it's straight into, I'm an artist who makes enough money to pay my bills, and I was just sitting down for no reason in my life, which I live for no reason, and my hand started drawing for no reason, and I drew this thing for no reason, and I'm loving it, because like, this is the sort of
life you dream of?
Well, that, and also the kind of story of purely in your head kind of living, that like, there's nothing going on in the world around this guy. Mm-hmm. That's a little bit of hyperbole, but... And as I go through it, enjoying it for this weird story mystery thing of it, I start to hear the voice of suspense in my head saying, you really like, this is what you like. You like what we're doing for you here? You're a cheap date. So, like, by the time I'm halfway through it, I'm really like, I really love this, and I feel really bad about myself for really enjoying it.
Because oh, no.
It's so purely this story. I mean, it really is just, we're characters who, for explicitly no reason, are interacting. And I mean, the sculptor at least has like, I have a job. I am doing this to go to a convention so I can show this thing off. But for the most part, these are just people who are just floating in narrative space, just doing what the narrative needs them to do.
Yeah.
Well, you also have to keep in mind this time period, I think, and the really interesting setting in August and this extreme heat. And I have 2 points about that. First point is no air conditioning. He's outside just because it's so unbearably hot.
Right.
He can't work in his studio. So some of his seeming like he's just lollygagging because of this weather. And then point two is, I just think it's interesting. I can't think of another supernatural story set during just oppressive heat. Mm. It's always fall. It's always dark. It's never burning sun out. And I found really appealing. And that was one thing that I hoped, if Eric liked nothing else about it, as a hater of heat and summer weather, yeah, that he would be like, this is when all horror stories should be set. Every monster should be sweating profusely.
There's a that Coen Brothers movie, Barton Fink. Oh, yeah. Which deals a lot with heat and makes me very uncomfortable. But I would say they could have done more to explore the uncomfortability of the heat.
Like them just saying, I'm hot. A lot more.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure. Now that you say that.
A lot of squishy noises.
Yeah. Okay. That's a good point.
But I like its minimalism, and I really felt the heat. The guy working outside with a chisel, and he's sweating. Again, just the fact that he's wandering around the streets for no reason because it's just too hot to go anywhere else or to be indoors at all. And that was very appealing to me. I also think because he's an artist, there's this implication of that he's has education and is somehow above believing in superstitious things. Given the time periods it's written, I think that's part of why they chose to characterize him as an artist and someone with free time like that.
I'm not saying what I said to be critical of the story. It's because it is so in my wheelhouse, it is uncomfortably rammed right up in my wheelhouse.
That was a visual I'll never get out of my head.
Nor is that to disagree with Eric's opinion, because my enjoyment of this is really personal.
You said an interesting thing, though, and it speaks volumes about understanding what you like in storytelling. You said these characters are floating in narrative free-for-all space. Like, they're unconnected, you know?
I mean, that's kind of the point of, why did I draw this? My hand has moved. Why did I walk here? I just got up and walked.
It occurs to me that a lot of radio drama that stars Vincent Price,
the character is
floating in narrative space.
Ooh, in his wheelhouse. Oh,
it's still sore, man.
Oh, man.
Is it true, though, that he doesn't really have, his characters are undefined in the sense of what do you do for a living and where are you?
Yeah, he's independently wealthy and educated and artistic.
Yeah.
That's always Vincent Price's
character. Thank you.
And I think that's the same as this character.
Yeah.
Yes, for Vincent Price, it is, I want to go eat at this restaurant. I want to go.
Yeah.
Well, you're talking specifically the Price of Fear.
Price of Fear, right? Yes.
Yeah. But
which is even heavily more autobiographical, except for the supernatural stuff.
And the cannibalism, right?
Yeah, what you're saying is that he's just wandering around. He doesn't know why. The next thing that was going to happen to him is all of a sudden my hand wrote Stairway to Heaven, right? The devil was pushing my hand. That happens a lot, though, with Vincent Price characters, too, in the sense of they seem floaty. Anyway, my point is you love Vincent Price. I see why you love this. It's got that same feel to it.
Ronald Coleman has a little of that Vincent Price in his voice.
Yeah, he does.
It's driving Aaron crazy.
No, I've said it before. If I know what the end is, and I know for the entire time, and it ends up that is what the end is, and I have to slowly get there, and nothing else happens along the way, I'm not interested. It's not. But you guys love Brechtian. You know the ending. It's the journey of how well you tell the story, even though we all know we're getting there. You guys love that.
Well,
me, not so much.
The emotion is the horror of the inevitable, that I can't get out of this lane.
Yeah.
And what I appreciate about it is that sensation of inevitability. Like you said, Tim, you can't escape. But then also, at the last minute, they don't really give you that satisfaction. It doesn't end up being the cathartic moment.
Are you, in your imagination, going to make this guy kill him?
And I also really like this strangely cozy domestic scene that is painted at the end that you can interpret either way. Oh, he's sharpening this chisel. He's about to stab this guy to death. Or it's a stranger who's offering this kindness to somebody who might be freaked out by this coincidence. Just stay until midnight and then no one has to worry about this.
Yeah. Let me change the name on the grave. Would that make you feel better?
Yes.
But they're sitting together in his workshop, and he's writing a letter, and he's working, and just change the angle slightly, and
that's a blossoming thruple.
Yeah.
I'm sure that was the subtext they were going for.
So The Prophet is an interesting insertion here, and I'll tell you what I immediately thought when Ronald Coleman reads this rather large excerpt for a 30-minute script of The Prophet. I thought, this story's really short. And The guy adapting it had just read The Prophet. In the short story, Atkinson's wife finds out that Wittencroft is an illustrator and shows off her Bible that's illustrated. I'm forgetting. It's a famous French illustrator, Doré, a French illustrator. And it just bores the pants off the artist. He's like, yes, Doré, super cliche. And so he swaps that out for this passage.
I'm thinking I'm probably going to make you laugh. So I, reading the intro to this, I've never heard of The Prophecy. Everything I know about The Prophet, The Prophet, there it is. The Prophet is in this paragraph we read in the beginning of this podcast. I do read here, according to what Joshua wrote for our intro, that this was a very popular book that
particularly mid-century.
Right. Yeah. So I'm a little embarrassed that I've never heard about it.
I've never heard of it. Don't be embarrassed.
Oh, good. All right.
You guys probably don't remember, but you're of an age where I guarantee your grandparents.
Sure.
And your parents somewhere had a copy of The Prophet.
Like, it's one of those books that lived near my grandparents.
Okay. It's one of those books that almost
everyone. But I lived near yours.
Creepy.
I lived with your grandparents and they had one.
Wow.
It's a famous book for everyone owning it, but nobody ever reading it.
Okay. So I'm hearing her read passages, and because I also don't know anything about the Bible, I assumed she was reading the Bible. Up until we read that intro, I thought she was reading the Bible.
Which is what was in the original short story.
Right.
Well, they don't read it. She's showing off the dirty pictures.
They sound the same to me in the flow and the style.
The Prophet was popular because of its humanist, universalist spirituality. So it was probably intentionally inserted in place of the Bible reference by the writer.
Was the Prophet's book intention to give the same rules to live by without the...
It was just a combination of Western and Eastern philosophy and poetry. It just was sort of...
Don't kill a guy.
Yeah, it wasn't intended to be a religion or anything. It was just basically a early poetic self-help book, but barely that.
Interesting. Kind of curious. I might read that. Seriously, you've intrigued me. Is it hard?
I've never read it. It just seems boring because it's so universalist as to almost feel like it applies to no one.
Ask my grandparents.
Any final thoughts? Tim, did you resist that inner suspense voice that was saying, oh, yeah, you like it? Or did you just give in and go, yeah?
No, it was just like, it just affected my enjoyment for the rest of the episode, tinted with a little bit of shame, which is, you know, normal state for me.
The Book of Lists. That's what we had in our house. Do you remember that was a big, in the 80s?
Kind of like Ripley's Believe It or Not.
Yeah, those were big. But do you remember, did you guys have the Book of Lists?
No.
I don't think I did.
Oh, that was a big deal. Everybody had one of those in their house. We'll talk about it later. You want to vote?
Sure.
You go first, Tim.
Sure. I can't even say this stands the test of time because it's part of why I like it, because it doesn't. This is really old-fashioned. Super fun. Had a good time. Felt dirty.
Felt dirty. Felt dirty. Oh, the things I like when they make me happy, I'm ashamed. Yeah, no. Nothing. I'm trying to think of something nice to say about it. Again, suspense? No. Ronald Coleman's fine. There was nothing really about it that grabbed me. And I'm so sorry, Josh. But this is what I do like about it. You ready? I'm kind of touched that you really wanted to find me you went out of your way to find a story that, oh, I can find him a Victorian story. And I do appreciate it a lot. Oh, that's really nice.
Mostly I just want to say, like, gotcha. But also a little sweetness was in there. Yes. I think I'm going to surprise no one by saying I prefer the ambiguity of the short story over suspense's attempt to really guide the listener. Mm-hmm. It makes sense from a suspense point of view that they want to build this suspense. There, I said it.
Eventually.
But what we didn't talk about, and I'll just mention it very briefly, is I just think the production is here is really, really strong. I love the minimalism. I love the sound of the chisel on the headstones.
Right.
I love the footsteps down the street. I like the music. I love Ronald Coleman for this role. I don't like him in a lot of roles because it's a strong, really, you instantly know that's Ronald Coleman and it can take you out. But because of the quality of this character, which we've already described, he's perfect for it.
Right.
And Dennis Huyawa. He somehow is able to suggest through his performance how oppressively hot it is, how enormously fat apparently he is.
Hell of a time.
You get all this through. So this is going to be one of our weirdest votes because I think this is a suspense classic in my book because I love this sense of just gnawing, building dread. And I think it's just expertly performed and produced. It just has that elegance to it where you see like stupid and simple.
The one thing I do have to give it praise for, an elevated level of praise, is this is a fantastic adaptation of this kind of story, of these kind of uncanny experiences, that it's not necessarily easy to capture that in audio format. And I think this does a really good job of adapting that genre and that experience.
Just listening to you guys vote on this bored me. Tim, tell them stuff.
Hey, please go visit ghoulishdelights.com if you like. There's other episodes there, but you can get these episodes wherever you get your podcasts. But at ghoulishdelights.com, you can leave comments. You can vote in polls. Let us know what you think of these. You can also find a link to our store and buy some merchandise themed with oh, my God. That was a...
Did you just say Dennis Huey?
I was about to plug Look My No Pants. Was about to...
That is a show that Tim and I were in 20 years ago.
Wow! Now I got to put some Look My No Pants swag on the store.
Oh, wow. Tim, are you moving toward the light?
You need to drop out of the presidential race.
You can go to our store and buy some Mysterious Old Radio Listening Society themed products. And you can also sign up for our Patreon.
Yes, go to lookmonopants.com/themorals. I'm sorry. Go to patreon.com/themorals and please support this podcast. Thank you to all our patrons who do support it. We really appreciate it. It is not only... one of the reasons we are able to continue doing the podcast is to have some compensation for it, but also it is just an amazing community. And we often are talking when we plug Patreon about, you know, extra podcasts and other perks like that. But I think the biggest perk is to be a part of this Morals community that is online. And it's a really friendly, welcoming, open community. And that's worth the price of admission. So go to patreon.com/themorals. Join us.
Speaking of community, you can see us performing live as the Mysterious Old Radio Listening Society Theater Company does recreations of classic old-time radio drama and a lot of our own original pieces live on stage monthly, sometimes more than once a month. You can find out where we're performing audio drama live by going to ghoulishdelights.com and find out where we are and how to get tickets and what we're performing each month. And usually it's in places that serve a really good food. So it makes for a great night out. And a lot of Patreons show up and we get to meet them there as well. Also, if you can't make it because they're all in the Twin Cities area, listen, someday we're gonna get one of them tour buses. We're gonna go around the country nonstop. But if you can't see us performing
tour live, tandem bicycles,
right? If you can't see us performing live, then you, as a Patreon, we film them, or at least the audio version of those live performances are available as part of your Patreon perks, so you can participate that way, or partake, I should say. All right, so coming up next, it's going to be my choice, and we're going to do The Adventures of Sam Spade, the Mad Scientist Caper. Until then...
Look out!
Barry Kroger stepped in for Ronald Coleman along with Dennis Huey. Huey? Huey?
No, I don't know. It says it in the broadcast, and I should have actually...
Huey!
It is a dumb-sounding name.
You have a dumb name, Dennis.
Sorry, Dennis. I'm glad you're dead.